Blog Talk Radio.
This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Mets Scene podcast, and we're so thankful that you are. I groove every time I hear that, and honestly, this is currently Mets Scene baseball like it ought to be. So we're trying to harken back to some championship days and party like it's 1986, as they say. So without further ado, let us go to our partners in crime, as we say, before we bring on our featured guest. And I'll start in Connecticut with Rich Sparago. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Sam. Nice to hear your voice. And I'll tell you, you know, these are good days in Metsville. I'm looking at a screen here on my computer, and it says playoff odds, New York Mets, greater than 99.9%. If that's a smile on anybody's face, I don't know what will, right? What a way to start out the podcast.
What a way. And down in Bensonhurst, we're going to go to Mike Lacolot. Mike, is this heaven?
It's not heaven. It's the metropolitan area, and it couldn't be more fun at the moment. It's, what, August 11th? And I'm having a blast. I'm not looking forward, but today, having a blast. Let's go, Mets.
Let's go, Mets. And we're going to head up a few blocks in Brooklyn to Crown Heights and go to Tomorrow Media director filmmaker Phil Maillard. What is going on, my Brooklyn brother?
Hey, guys. So it's not heaven yet, but it's the stairway to heaven, like Led Zeppelin says, you know. And we get up the stairs, and at the top is heaven. So that's where we're
and
at.
And as
stairway
we wind on down the road. So, Phil, I'll start with you. You know, you've been through a lot of Metsian seasons, to hearken to our podcast name, Shameless Plug. And just I can't remember whether we've had you on in this podcast this year, but I know that it's been a while one way or another. So give us your overall outlook with this team and how you've been feeling, and also how you think it compares and contrasts to Mets team of a yonder lord.
Well, it's funny because August in Mets history, for those of us that have been around for most of it, knows that August has always been a crucial month in any playoff run for the Mets in our history, except for really 86 and 2006 when we just kind of rule the roost all season. The majority of times we end up in the postseason, moves were made in the month of August, whether it was trades or we just played well, that closed the gap on some big leads that were in front of us. So those were just special teams, you know, 69, 73, you know, even against up to the World Series with the Yankees, 2015. I mean, moves were made and stuff happened, but we all know what's sustainable because it just wasn't built that way. This is different. This is checking all the boxes you would want to check on a championship run in any sport by any team. You have a savvy manager that gets along with his players. Some players having career years, even though they're already Hall of Famers. You have a mix of new guys that have brought a new attitude in. You have a leader in Scherzer. You have a front office that was smart and didn't overshoot its skis in free agency or in trades and got players to kind of complement what we have, which is smart. You had moments of conflict and resolution, and we've had moments where it looked like the powers would tip and we just responded, and now we're just crushing people. So it is the real deal. This is what 86 was like, if for those of us that remember.
So, Rich, you know, he mentioned the trade deadline, and that was the last time the Mets Scene podcast was on here. You guys were there. I unfortunately wasn't able to make it, and I believe it was around, like, July 28th. The Tyler Naquin trade had happened. Daniel Vogelbach had happened. Darren Ruff had not happened. But, you know, like Phil just said, the front office, much to the chagrin of certain fans, was very measured. And I saw one particular tweet that just, you know, put it kind of in very, you know, simple laden terms, that the Mets were able to replace J.D. Davis, Dom Smith, and Travis Jankowski with Tyler Naquin, Daniel Vogelbach, and Darren Ruff. And so far, so good. Everything's covering up Epler here.
Yep.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know. Go ahead, Phil.
No, I'm disagreeing. I mean, it reminds you of 2015, and not so much Cespedes, but guys like Uribe and was it Kelly Johnson? Was that his name?
Yeah.
Those guys came and fit right in with that group of people and brought something. And Vogelbach is already a folk hero. I mean, that when you have a folk hero in the middle of your season, then it's a memorable season for your fans. Because, you know, like Benny Agbayani would be kind of like a folk hero in Mets lore. You know, we are a few. But that's what really makes the season a signature season. If you win and you got a folk hero.
Yeah. You know, and the approach, as Sam said, it's all coming up Epler. You know, as fans, we all want the big name, right? That's just natural. You want Juan Soto. Of course, there was no way Rizzo was trading Soto to anybody in the division, but we want Soto. You can dream. We want Wilson Contreras. You know, we want the big names. And, well, that didn't happen. But on the other hand, you have to ask yourself the other question, the flip side question, which is, are those big names needed to win? And I think you're seeing that the answer is no. You know, when I watch this Mets team, I'm getting a vibe of the 86 Mets in the sense that that team relied on platoons, right? That team, Lenny Dykstra, Mookie Wilson, Kevin Mitchell would play on occasion, right? It was mixed and matched. I'm getting a bit of a 2016 Cubs vibe as well, where everybody was mixed and matched and using guys to what you could get from them. And I read somewhere, I don't remember who wrote it, but I read somewhere where they said, you know, neither Tyler Naquin or Ruff, Darren Ruff, neither one is an all-star. They're each half a player. But when you put them together, you have a pretty good player, and that's okay. And that's what the Mets did. You know, you don't have to populate your team with a roster of all-stars. You just have to get the most out of every position. And sure, the Mets have some all-stars, for, you know, absolutely, you know, with Pete and McNeil and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, you have a team here where the parts just work together to maximize the position on the field and the place in the batting order. You're seeing it, you know, and, you know, we've all heard it. The Mets had the lowest OPS from their DH, and now they're third since they made the trades. They're third in OPS from DH. So that's the kind of thing they're getting, and they did it by, instead of, you know, gutting the farm system and bringing in quote-unquote star players, they did it by bringing in parts that work together. And like I said, and I'll leave it at this, if you're a Mets fan, don't look any farther than 1986. That was a team that had a lot of platoons. The 2016 Cubs had a lot of mix-and-match parts. Ben Zobrist played all over the field for them. And it can work, and we're seeing it work.
Mike, you know, I want to go a little deep cut with some of these players that we've been talking about in terms of the trading deadline, but, you know, let's round this overall broad view out, and especially, you know, we got to talk the Atlanta series, and I'll just, considering that I just pulled up the standings, here's a good broad stroke. They have a run differential of 127. Home, they are 38-18, which is a great record. Away, they're 35-21, so they're 14 games over 500. And what do they say? Win at home, stay 500 on the road. They are so much better than that. And they're 31-22 against people over 500. This team, you know, who has not lost more than three in a row this year, who has won the majority by far of their series, other than a couple splits and really just a couple to three, I think, series losses. This is just one of the most consistent teams I've ever seen, for sure, and I think most of us have ever seen.
This is a good team. We're in August, and, you know, teams have identified themselves. There's only four major league teams with 70 or more wins, and the Mets are one of them. To pick up on Rich's point, he's absolutely right. Extensive renovations weren't necessary, and what Eppley did was essentially fix a leaky roof and replace the windows, and now the lineup is watertight. And to pick up on Phil's point, he brought up the month of August. You know, a year ago, right around this time, we were getting swept by the Phillies, and that's when we initially seeded first place. And then fast forward, right around August 14th, that's when we were getting swept by the Dodgers. We fell out of first place, and we never climbed back atop the National League East standings again. So, you know, this team compared to last summer has made a 180 degree turn for the better. And like I said, to start the show, I'm having fun. This is just pure fun. It really is. And, you know, we're going to jump into the Braves and get a lot more in detail, but you know, the Braves came on like gangbusters and chopped a 10.5 game lead down to 3.5 games, and we saw what happened. And, you know, Metsville is a happy place right now.
We certainly are. So, Phil, I'm going to go to you. You were mentioning the folk hero, Daniel Vogelbach. You know, I want to talk about both him. I think Ruff has a little bit of a smaller – prolific hitting window, catalog since the trading deadline. But he's certainly come through, and he has showed his worth plenty. But Vogelbach and Naquin, I mean, you know, both were kind of brought in to Platoon, but in many ways they have earned more playing time. So let's start with Vogelbach and take it with Naquin at the end there. What has really impressed you the most about those two players?
Well, I had never really even heard of either one of them. I very rarely see the Pirates or the Reds. So I couldn't remember Naquin and Vogelbach. I don't think the one time or two times Pirates were on TV with the Mets, I saw him. But he's every guy. I mean, you know, physically, he is probably 75% of the men in Citi Field at any given moment. And so he is, you know, you're kind of living vicariously through him and his abilities, and he's just been delivering. Now, it'd be interesting moving forward because he hasn't hit a ball to the other fields yet. Everything is left field, how teams adjust as we get to the playoffs. But right now, he's just fun to watch. I mean, he's hustling. He's an athlete. He's good. You know, he's a folk hero. He's a Vogelbach. Can't beat that. You know, as far as Naquin, yeah, man, he is the big sexy. He's taken over for Bartolo as the big sexy now. Ruff is interesting. Oh, Naquin, rather. Naquin is really a good player. I think he's platoon with Canna is perfect. He's a great player.
I would agree. So let's go around the horn, Rich. Those two players, as well as what you've seen from Ruff, by all means.
Well, just to add on to what Phil said, Vogelbach, you know, you look at him, right, and the first thing you're thinking is all or nothing slugger. It's an unfair one, but it's a bias when you look at him. But that's not who he is. You know, he takes great at bats. He hits the ball the other way.
is on. He's almost, you know, legendarily nearly a 500 OBP since joining the Mets. So you have a guy there who fits the current scheme of baseball. You know, he knows what his job is. He gets on base. I know that's an old cliche from Moneyball, but that is true. And then with Darren Ruff, here's a guy who, you know, you heard Keith talking about it the other night, who was with the Phillies, went to Korea for 3 years, came back, was part of that crazy Giants run last year where they had nothing but role players on that team, and he was one of them. He did the job admirably well. Naquin's a bit different. You know, Naquin is probably the most versatile of the three. You know, he's a good defender. He's a very good outfielder. He has some speed. He certainly hits righties. He could probably hit lefties a little bit. So he's probably the closest to a complete player. But again, you could see, you know, Mike has talked about this on this podcast, but having a plan and sticking to the plan. We've talked about that for years. And you could see that that's what the Mets did. You know, they had a plan, which was, look, we don't have a lot of great assets. We have some really good ones, but we don't have a lot of them in the farm system. So we have to protect that to have sustainable winning. But how do you win today? Not just think about sustainability, but how do you also try to win today? Well, you do use money, which they certainly have. But secondly, you acquire players that don't cost you to gut your farm system, which would violate principle number one about sustainability, right? So they went out and they got guys who are, and I'm using air quotes here, affordable, but guys who fit the profile of what they wanted. They were okay with getting half players as long as you got the other half, right? And they did that. And they did that without gutting the farm system. They put together a team that certainly has, like I said earlier, its share of stars, but doesn't have you don't have to be a team full of all-stars. The team just works. It clicks. And I think that's what you're seeing. You know, I think that's exactly what you're seeing. Everybody on the team they all have a role. They know their role. They stick to the role. The front office sticks to its plan, and it's coming to fruition.
So going with that, Mike, you know, talking about sticking to the plan, it's basically, I think, in many ways with some of these players. Obviously, like Darren Ruff, he's coming from a team that could be in a position, is certainly in a position to make a run for it, but not nearly what they were at the 106-win Giants and arguably one of the greatest pennant races of all time last year. And, of course, with Tyler Naquin coming from Cincinnati and Vogelbach coming from Pittsburgh, I think it's both, you know, what Epler was able to recognize and where these players, these quote-unquote half players, no disrespect, but on paper, where they were coming from, having been on this non-inspired, on some of these non-inspired ball clubs, although the Giants are always inspired. You know, I think it's a combination of what Epler was looking to do, but also these players taking the opportunity and just being reinvigorated and running with it, you know, being on a team that was already seemingly gelling so well. And just, you know, it's been well documented so far. These personalities have just entered into this winning formula seamlessly.
Two things. Change of scenery is a real thing, and winning is contagious. And when you're an incoming player entering a winning condition, you know, you get sick in a good way. And as you mentioned, defining roles, players thrive on that. They don't like coming to the ballpark not knowing, you know, how they fit in or what their role is or how it is they're going to contribute to the team. These guys know exactly what their role is. So that's a comforting condition to be operating in. And right now, it's a very fine, well-oiled machine. Billy Epler's trade deadline acquisitions were met with initial criticism. Because they weren't filled with fluff, but the performances of these individuals speaks for itself, and that's all that matters. They're getting it done. Doesn't matter what the four of us say on this podcast. those four are performing, or three, I should say, three batters. They're performing, and that's all that matters. And they're turning this into an exceptional summer, and the Mets continue to take big bites out of the dog days of summer. And, you know, hooray Billy Epler. We've been saying it many times on this podcast in recent episodes, right, Rich? That let's see what Billy Epler does. This is on Billy Epler. Billy Epler this and Billy Epler that. Well, his time came. He made some transactions, and they're working, regardless of what we think or the naysayers think. Let's forecast. I mean, or let's rewind a little bit. How about the offseason acquisition? Marte. Mm. You know, Chris Bassett and their performance, and now how these players complement his offseason acquisition. So in his first full season as GM of the Mets, you know, he's earning himself a good grade. And if you forecast, you know, to get to 100 wins, I really don't want to go down this route. But the Mets just need to play slightly over 500 baseball. That's a good team. And that's a good job by Billy Epler. Yeah. Well, that's the last
it really
time you
is,
mentioned Sandy Alderson's name.
Right. Well, I have to give a shout-out to Baseball and Barbecue because they had one of the most stripped-down, comfortable conversations with Sandy Alderson I've ever heard. So anybody who wants to put Sandy in a good place in their head needs to go head over and listen to that conversation, which was had sometime, I believe, at close to the beginning of the season. But you're right, though, that Sandy's been able, and I forget whether we talked about this on a podcast, although it's been a while that I've been able to make it. So, Mike, I think you and I were talking about how Sandy Alderson has been able to kind of finally just do the job he was originally hired to do, and they're still looking for that one more piece, even as Billy Epler has handled this season and got to throw out Scherzer there because, you know, what a bulldog he's been. And, you know, everybody kind of called him insurance policy to DeGrom, and DeGrom's where I want to go next, Mike. But after that, Scherzer, hey, he's been a major influence combined with Buck on this clubhouse.
Indeed. Indeed. Well said. I'm not going to add much more to it. He's a leader and he's a teacher, and he's been teaching this pitching staff along the way and other players about mental attitude and approach. So, you know, he offers a lot more than what his right arm produces on the mound. And, you know, let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets.
By the way,
let's go back.
By the way, real quickly, I'm sorry. That was an off-the-record conversation we had about Sandy Alderson, because technically the Mets still do not have a president of baseball operations, and we wondered.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, that's minutia at the moment.
It really is, and, you know, it's kind of been out of sight, out of mind because of the way they've been playing and the way it has been. You know, last year, just it was such an obvious transitional year where you kind of had a hybrid of a Wilpon season and a new Cohen season. And I don't want to go too far off the course, but that's really what it feels. And this was like the true Steve Cohen statement year. So something to think about. But before we get, I think, because the Braves series, I think, is the major crux of what we've been looking at. I want to get to Jacob DeGrom. He has returned, and prior to the Braves series, he returned, and it was like he didn't miss a beat, both in the way he performed, Rich, but also in the support that he garnered, or lack thereof.
Yeah, well, when you think about what happened on Sunday, it was so multifactorial, right? Because fans were, you had to beat the Braves because you wanted to take 4 out of 5. I would have signed for 3 out of 5 in that series. 4 out of 5 was just amazing. Okay, so you wanted to beat the Braves, you wanted to win that game, because obviously the old cliche, it's a two-game swing in the standings, right? Okay, fine. But the other thing that we were all looking at, clearly, was whatever DeGrom does on the mound is going to have a lot to do with how we feel about the rest of the season. Because if we saw a really good, you know, if we saw what we saw, the really good, dominant DeGrom, we're thinking, wow. The plan that we heard in, it was the, like November 30th, I think they officially signed Scherzer, maybe it was December 1st. That plan that we have been salivating for 8 months finally came to fruition, you know, DeGrom and Scherzer. Now, if DeGrom had gone out, God forbid, come out of the game with some kind of an injury or just didn't look right, tell me our mood would be exactly as positive as it is. Of course it wouldn't be. So it was about winning that game, but it was also, and probably more importantly, about how DeGrom looked, how he came out of the start, and how that would set the Mets up for the rest of the season. And so what we saw from DeGrom, if anybody expected that, I'd like to meet that person. That clearly exceeded expectations. 12 strikeouts in 6 innings. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, that, not even 6 innings. Come on. That's just, he was razor sharp slider. He was throwing 100. He was doing everything as if he hadn't missed a beat. So I think that, as much as a 7-game lead in the standings, I think that is what's giving so much optimism around here, because now you can go into a postseason series with DeGrom, Scherzer, and Bassett, or whoever, you know, plug in your third starter from between Bassett, Carrasco, and Walker. I know people have different opinions on that. But thinking about the way this team is lined up, man, that DeGrom start went a long way. It did a lot for our psyche, and I think that's why Met fans are finally happy.
That's definitely a big reason. And Phil, if we're going to deep cut that game, I mean, I'm not sure where you were. I'm not sure how much you were paying attention to it, but I remember that, especially with the, you know, being in the context of having a combined no-hitter, you know, I think every Met fan, every Met fan understood that Jacob DeGrom was not going to be finishing this potential perfect game. And,
right, yeah.
You know, I certainly started having dreams of him keeping his pitch count down, making it all the way to 8 innings and just passing it to Edwin Diaz. But it was already, other than those crazy dreams, it was already way above and beyond just him showing that he's the exact Jacob DeGrom that left off last year on a historic pace.
You know, for me, it's funny because, of course, his performance is amazing. But after the second or third inning, it was like I sat there comfortable because I've seen this before. And that's kind of funny because we hadn't seen it in 2 years or, you know, or whatever, but I kind of settled into what I'm used to seeing. And that was a comforting feeling because some things are back that had a chance to go away. And even whatever time we have with it, that was a special moment. And I think a lot of Met fans probably felt comfortable. You know, we could take a deep breath and exhale. Hey, you know, he's back. And that adds to what I mean about this season being special. The one thing I want to mention about the Braves series, which impressed me most of all, was actually Buck Showalter. Because he changed his managing style as soon as this series started. He changed his pinch hitting. New guys to work in. He changed his lineup, platoons, the way he used pitchers, the way he managed in this series from game to game was so encouraging to me, because each game we don't know what the players will do and what that score will be, but we can check this box. There's a 99% chance that we will never be outmanaged. And as a Met fan, that is so important to know that we're in every single game against every single opponent because of our manager. And that's huge. And that's what I came away with this series with. Yep.
And Mike, before I talk about off the record conversation, you know, I was getting a little ahead of it when it comes to potential manager matchups, if you will. But I just, that's a little tease for everybody. We don't need to go deep cut with that because I want to stay on Jacob DeGrom. And one of the big things about that game against the Braves was the fact that the first, I believe it was 18 sliders, were swung on and missed. That was a major part of the narrative that day, was the fact that nobody could touch his slider, and that the fouls, when people at the end of his running of his time there on the mound were able to foul it off, that was a big deal. That was a great feat.
It was an incredible performance, and you have to think about it this way: he faced 19 batters and struck out 12 of them, allowed one hit. That's really good. 19 batters he faced and he struck out 12. We read
that's
that box score the other way. And, you know, he struck out 12 in 5.2 innings. No, he faced 19 batters and struck out 12 of them. DeGrom is back. And more than that, the series, that was the unveiling. That was the Citi Field unveiling of Flushing's dynamic duo of DeGrom and Scherzer. Citi Field had yet to witness that. And, well, we saw what we got.
And that's going to be a nice deep cut after this, talking about the Braves series and the fact that David Peterson held his own, setting us up for that Scherzer-DeGrom dynamic duo. And before we get into that, this is the Mets Scene podcast that you are listening to, and we are so thankful that you are. And we're going to press the reset button here close a little bit after the half hour and go to Phil Maillard, our featured guest for the evening. And Phil, give us some, you know, we've been on the podcast before, but other than the shameless plug as to what you do, and where everybody can find you, tell everybody your Metsian story if they have not heard it.
Well, unfortunately, I have to admit I'm the same age as the Mets. We're both born the same year, so I've been following them since I've been 7, 8 years old. I go to the 69 World Series, so I've lived through it all, pretty much seen everything. And so it is my team I'm stuck with, and but loving it. And I've been in the film business for 37-plus years. I have a company called Tomorrow Media, T-U-M-A-R-O, Media. And we do a couple documentaries, and we have some things in development.
Well, excellent. And since you mentioned Buck, I want to start here with that first game against Atlanta, Phil, as we get into that. This was the first game was the perfect example of how the Mets are not going to get outmanaged. And Buck made it clear that this was a particular game that they needed to have. And every Mets fan knew that they needed to make a statement, not only because I believe they were 3.5 at the time going into that game. They were 3.5 ahead of Atlanta with a 5-game series ahead. Meaning that if they could take this game with 4 games left, it didn't matter whether the Braves then took 4 out of 5. The Mets would find themselves having taken that first game still in first place. But however, the way it obviously all worked out was that the Mets made a major statement that no matter how hot the Braves are against the rest of the league, they are going to have trouble with the Mets. But that first game, that 6-out save with Edwin Diaz, you know, kind of with the cherry on top, having a Taijuan Walker a meme that got started, regardless of what his performance was the next day. It was exactly what you wanted out of this 2022 New York Mets team going into a series like this.
Absolutely. I mean, the way Buck approached that game, he had a plan. It wasn't reactionary. And like I said, he was 2 or 3 steps ahead of the Braves. And it was so refreshing and comforting knowing that this guy could step up his game and change direction in the middle of a series, in the middle of a game, seamlessly, and put everybody in the right position and his players to succeed. So it's not a surprise that that trickles down throughout the dugout, throughout the clubhouse with the players, knowing that there's trust in there, knowing that if they fail, their teammates will pick them up. Buck has instilled all that. Some of the plays you're seeing on the bases, we haven't seen it in Mets uniforms in, I don't know, 2006 maybe. That's all Buck.
Rich, I want to give credit where credit's due, and I want to go deep cut with Francisco Lindor at some point here. But as we talk about this first game, and I look at how the scoring got started, you have to mention that Pete Alonso may be the new captain of this team. And, you know, coming out of his rookie season, followed by a pandemic year, and then with you know, just a little bit under 100 RBIs last year, but still showing you that he's going to be a force to be reckoned with, this year has just been absolutely, he is the anchor of the offense. And, you know, defense aside, I think he needs to get more credit where credit's due for not being a liability out there, even if, you know, you saw a ball bounce off the heels of his glove that didn't end up costing the Mets in the long run, but still something to mention. Pete Alonso at some point we're going to be talking about, really right now we need to be talking about locking this guy up long term.
Well, yeah, I think the Mets have some very critical decisions to make. You know, you just saw the Braves did with Austin Riley. You know, they said, okay, look, you've got two more years of team control, but we're going to buy you out of that and sign you for a long-term deal. Howie Rose was talking about this the other day, and he was saying that it averages out to $21 million a year for 10 years. And if you think about what some of these guys are getting paid, think about what Lindor's getting paid. Lindor's getting paid 34. Of course, you can't draw a direct comparison. They're different kinds of players, essentially. But $21 million a year by the standards of Lindor and, you know, some of these other big contracts could kind of be a bargain. Howie might be right, you know, kind of being a bargain. And so the Mets might want to think about that with Pete because, you know, 19, 20, 21, 22, so that means he has two more years of team control. Maybe you have to think about, you know, offer it because these guys typically will accept a little bit less and less in quotes, you know, if you buy them out early. So this way they're guaranteed the money early on. That might be something the Mets have to think about. They also need to be thinking about Brandon Nimmo and Edwin Diaz. You know, these are guys who could be free agents and critical pieces of this team. And so, and what does all this point to? You know, potentially DeGrom opting out. Who knows what's going to happen there? What this all points to is you have to make hay while the sun shines. And now, Billy Epler didn't do anything stupid. We talked about that. He avoided doing anything crazy at the deadline. But at the same time, who knows how long this window will be open for the Mets. You know, Scherzer's 38. DeGrom might opt out. You don't know what's going to happen with Diaz and Nimmo. Hopefully you can bring them back. Pete Alonso, you know, two more years of team control. These are problems every team has, but what I'm saying is these are all those kinds of things they have to think about, you know, about winning today, long-term sustainability. And Pete is a great example, Sam, that you brought up. You know, here's a guy that probably if his trajectory continues as it is, probably will be able to command huge dollars in a couple of years. So, you know, the Mets are going to have a constantly like a carousel of decisions they have to make all the time. Some are going to be tough ones. They're not going to be able to retain everybody, but yeah. And Pete would be a great example of, do you try to buy him out now? Do you wait it out for a couple more years? Who knows? But this is in addition to trying to win today and win tomorrow, these personnel decisions will just keep coming up.
Exactly, and I think when you look at, Mike, the way that the Mets are with their new ownership and also the trajectory of the rest of the league and the way people have been locking up some of these franchise-altering players very early on, so you don't have a Bryce Harper situation, so you don't have a Juan Soto situation, even a Manny Machado situation. I think Pete is a perfect example of how you need, and especially the way him and Lindor have combined this year. Before we segue over to Lindor, I think it's a no-brainer, Mike. You have potentially, I'm taking this from, I believe, Joe Beningo was saying it with Evan Roberts, because Beningo's back on WFAN, that you could potentially have the greatest position player the Mets have ever had. Like, Pete Alonso is that good. Again, not to discredit how good Lindor could be over the next 10 years.
The biggest factor here is his age. He's 27. So you have to give him very serious consideration insofar as those mega contracts go. I hate them, but again, he's 27 years old, so you got to give this very serious consideration because, as you say, Sam, he's a cornerstone of this team and should be for years to come. He's unique. You don't take this stance with everybody. And you look around, for instance, I mean, Rich nailed it insofar as, player retention. He nailed it. But look around. Nimmo's 29. I want him retained. He's carved out a niche as a premier leadoff hitter. But, again, age. Nimmo's 29. Look at McNeil. He's 30. You know, Alonso's 27. And that's a very huge factor when you negotiate these contracts.
So, Phil, I'm going to go over to Francisco Lindor now, talking about this Braves series where – he continues to make the haters eat their words, as I like to say. And earlier in the year, you know, he was showing his worth even with a .245 batting average. But I kept saying, when it comes to Lindor, no matter the RBI numbers, no matter the home run numbers, I just want to see that average a little higher. And, you know, I remember some people saying last year that this is typical Lindor one way or another. He usually heats up as the year goes on, considering he's into the 270s. And that's really all I wanted out of him, was a 275 batting average overall. But when he gets hot, you know, the sky's the limit, really, with that batting average even. I mean, and right now he is carving himself out to have the greatest season a shortstop has ever had offensively for the New York Metropolitans.
Yeah, I think Francisco, given what has happened to him, he's become more comfortable in his role on this team. He's played well for the whole year. But remember, last year was kind of tumultuous. And the team is having success. Alonso is the guy with the home runs. Francisco was anchoring the defense. You see him, people coming off the field. He's talking to them after he gets at bat, whispering. He's talking to Buck all the time. And now as he comes to the All-Star break, he says, this is who I am on this team. And this is what my role needs to be for us to be successful. I need to do this. And that's what you see him doing. That's what he said when they asked him about tying Reyes. I'm here to win a World Series. Reason why, from here out, the rest of the season, health-wise, he's going to be fantastic. Because he's like, this is who I am on this team. This is who I need to be on this team.
Rich, you know, this may seem like a stretch, but how important, even though it was during, you know, kind of a collapse, if you will, infamously the 2021 season wound up that way. But how important do you think that three home run game against the Yankees, where he basically single-handedly won against the alternate New York baseball team, how important do you think that was in making him comfortable with this city and this team, regardless of the fact that personnel has certainly changed in 2022?
Yeah, I don't think it did much for the Mets collectively, but I think for him, that may have been his moment, you know? That may have been the moment where he turned the fans more on his side, because let's face it, by that point, they're playing the Yankees. The Mets were clinging to life, you know, as my late aunt used to say, with one foot on a banana peel and one foot in a grave, right? So they were basically, you know, barely alive in the pennant race. So the game didn't mean much that way. But beating the Yankees always matters, you know. And he comes up with the three home run game, and that may have been the point where the fans more or less opened their arms to him and embraced him as, okay, you know what? We know we've been hard on you all year. We know the season has gone to trash, but in a game that meant something to us, you showed up, you know. And not only did he do that, remember, in that game, remember that was the game where he got into it with Stanton, and he was kind of jawing at Stanton a little bit, and they had the benches clearing incident. And so if you put all that together, you know, as I think about it now, yeah, I think maybe he did cross the threshold there with the Mets fans. And they said, okay, you know, this guy, like I said, the season is not working out the way we wanted it to, and this guy hasn't worked out the way we wanted him to, but this guy's worth something, and this guy's okay. You know, he showed up for this game. He was willing to take on the big, bad Yankees. You know, so maybe he did earn his – or make his bones, is that the way the cliche goes, in that particular game. And it came at the end of the year, but maybe it left the fan base with a far more positive taste in their mouths about him, and to a point where, you know, this year they've completely embraced him. Like, that stuff from last year, I don't even think about it anymore. You know, it's so far in the past now, and maybe that game was the first step toward doing that, toward washing it away.
It is. It quite possibly was. Mike, you know, round us out with Francisco Lindor. You know, what have you seen? What is he doing differently? What is he doing better? Other than just hitting the ball better. But, like, what if we're deep diving the approach, what do you see?
I'm sorry. Promoting team unity. I see that first and foremost. But he's been clutch, and he's been a leader. He's 28 years old, but he's been a leader, and he's been productive. I'm not hung up on that batting average. Look, McNeil's been the team's only consistent 300 hitter. Batting averages, let me put it to you this way. For all our lives and for the better part of 150 years of baseball, the baseball hit back through the middle used to be a base hit up until a couple of years ago. Now they get scooped up like, dust on a rug by a vacuum cleaner. There's somebody there. The shortstop is always right behind second base. Those used to be hits. But shifting and defensive positioning have forced us to learn how to reinterpret the batting average. It's not what it used to be. Look around all of baseball and count the 300 hitters that exist and compare that to other seasons and other decades. So the shift has obviously made an impact on the batting average. He's hitting 270, which is okay for me. Again, the collective batting average in baseball is down. And pay attention when you watch baseball and look at these balls being hit up the middle. Again, for all our lives, they used to be base hits. But now they're getting scooped up 8 out of 10 times.
And it's going to be interesting to see the way the quote-unquote shift ban, works into that next year. And that's something that, you know, I don't want to – it's going to give me a headache to go into right now, because it's not like shifts haven't existed before. They've just gotten so out of whack that obviously they need to have rules. But I don't want it to negate what it was when people weren't so crazy with these shifts. But that's a whole other conversation for a whole other day. And in wrapping up the Atlanta series, I'm kind of going to go broad stroke with the Mets since the All-Star break. And Rich, I like the way the games finished, David Peterson, Max Scherzer, and Jacob deGrom kind of plays into my overall arc with this team and looking at it since the All-Star break. You know, the against the Padres, that was a pretty crazy game, and they took control sometime in the middle innings. But when you look at these wins, including the wins against the Braves, you really only see, like, a couple games that were nail-biters, you know, against the Yankees on the 27th, against the Marlins on the 29th. But that first game against Atlanta, and a little bit because, you know, that first game against the Braves with Peterson shouldn't have been as close. They shouldn't have used Edwin Diaz if we're all of a sudden, you know, we've been such an optimistic bunch this one. I guess you got to have a little bit of a rein in the podcast and the typical Jesus complaints. But you look at all of these games, and overall, they've had major control early on throughout all of these games. And today, you know, they needed to cement what they've done, or yesterday, excuse me. They needed to cement how well they've been winning, and they did it, you know, with a plomp 10-2 against the Reds. They've not only been winning, but they've been winning very convincingly.
They have, and I think, you know, and it's interesting because they're 15-4 since the All-Star break. That's freaking phenomenal, right? And in those games, if you analyze them, and we did a little bit on the last podcast, the Padres series, they came out of the gate the first two games they couldn't hit, right? And the last game in Chicago before the break, they couldn't hit there either. So, okay, three games where they couldn't hit. It was almost like the faucet went on, and I believe it was the fifth inning of that Padres game when they just assaulted the Padres, you know, and they ended up burying them in that game, and they haven't stopped hitting since. And so what you're seeing now is a good team that's hitting its stride at the right time. You know, we all know those old adages about how it's when you get hot and you have to peak at the right time. Well, the Mets are peaking now. Let's hope they can sustain it, you know, through the rest of the season into the postseason. But everything is gelling together now. And you're right. They are winning fairly convincingly now, with a couple of exceptions, as you said. And then if you think about the schedule coming up, you know, I did a piece for Mesmerize on this week. And if you think about the schedule coming up, the Mets have some choppy waters coming up. You know, they've got two against the Yankees. That's hard. You know, those are 12 difficult games. And they're going to need to stay at their peak to, you know, to perform well in those 12 games. Now, after those games, the Mets schedule is really, really soft. I mean, going into September, you know, the Mets play, they have six against the Nationals. They play the Rockies. They play seven against the Pirates. I mean, it's kind of, well, I don't want to say too much, but they're playing a lot of second division teams. The only good team they play after the Yankees, the only thing they play is they play the Braves again at the very end of the season. So, but what they have to do is stay right now. Everything is clicking. They're firing on all cylinders. They're going to need to keep doing that to get through this next 12 games. This is yet – you talked about tests earlier in the podcast, Sam. This is another one. You know, let's face it. You don't want to come out of this 12-game series, this 12-game stretch going 5-7 or something like that. You know, you want to stay hot. And that's – yes, they've been winning convincingly. They're going to have a chance against some tougher competitions. Kind of been mixed since the All-Star break. You know, you had the Reds in there. Certainly had the Braves for five, but you had the Reds in there too. So, but the next 12, let's see if the well-oiled machine, as you said earlier, let's see if the oil stays in the machine, and they could beat the really tough opponents they have coming up. And we'll check in again after these next 12 games and see how they did.
And that we certainly will, and that's a good transition, Phil. I'll start here, the Phillies. They are 40-18, and I forget who their current manager is, but they are 40-18 since firing Joe Girardi. Hey, Phil, you there?
Maybe he's on mute.
Yeah, I was on mute. Sorry about that. No, the Phillies have been
dollar in the jar.
The Phillies have been lurking for a little while there. They're right on Atlanta's butt. So, you know, this series that we're going to see them over the next week is extremely important because, man, we owe the Phillies big time. We owe them big time, but we can't play around. So this is huge.
And that's a good point. And I was just going back to the standings right now, Mike. But when looking at them, I believe if I look at the wild card standings, that both the – all right, so, yeah, there we go. Yeah, so Philly's right on the heels of the Braves. Well, not exactly right on the heels, but trying to make up about 3.5 games, I believe. But they are 0.5 up on the third-place San Diego Padres. You know, the AL East is always getting the credit, but here we are with potentially three teams from the NL East in the playoffs.
That is correct. A couple of things, a couple of darts I just want to throw at the wall. General manager of the Padres, he was in the mix for the Mets general manager's job when they were interviewing, right?
Right.
Phillies, don't rule them out. They got Joe Girardi fired with miserable play, and they're still exhibiting miserable defense. And Keith Hernandez has been trolling them to death, and it actually made the papers now that Philadelphia is upset with Keith Hernandez. It's been hysterical, if you've been listening to the games on SNY. But, yeah, don't rule the Phillies out, and they could they can be trouble. Mets need to stay on their guard and keep pushing forward.
So, Rich, you know, going to the, like you brought it up, and the schedule coming forward, let's specifically talk about the next series, the Phils. What say you? You know, these pitching matchups are probably some of the best in the biz.
They are. The Mets will miss Syndergaard. But they will see Nola and Wheeler. And so right then and there, you know, if you're seeing Nola and Wheeler, you have your work cut out for you through the games. I don't have it in front of me who the third pitcher might be in that series. But so you're seeing Wheeler and Nola. And then you have Scherzer and DeGrom, you know, going for the Mets, which is great. And so those, yeah, I mean, you're going to see in six games, you're going to see four elite pitchers. And like Mike said, you know, and like everybody, and like Phil said too, you can't sleep on these guys. I don't think the Phillies can overtake the Mets for their division, but having six games against the Phillies in the course of the next 11 days, a lot. You know, that's a lot. You're, and then in between, it's worse. You know, in between, you've got the Braves for four. So, you know. Look, I have every reason to believe, I think we have every reason to believe the Mets will hold their own in these series. Now, granted, of these games against the Phillies and the Braves, 7 of the 10 are away from Citi Field. That adds a little bit of complexity there. But we have every reason to believe the Mets will certainly hold their own. But, yeah, I mean, there's going to be some tough baseball over the next 2 weeks. Starting 2 weeks from tomorrow, they play the Rockies. Then, again, they launch into that soft September schedule. But over the next 12 days, starting with this Philly series, and then it will repeat itself the following weekend. Now, if you have Scherzer and DeGrom going on Friday and Saturday, let's see, how does that line up? Well, Scherzer probably won't see the Phillies. DeGrom might see the Phillies in the first game of the series down there, but you also got that Braves series to worry about. So, you know, we're enjoying it. I don't think anybody's, you know, counting any chickens before they've hatched, but it'll be another test for the Mets, and I'm looking forward to it. You know, coming off pummeling the Reds, that was great. That's what you're supposed to do. That's how the Yankees made their dollars in the late 90s, early 2000s. They would absolutely beat the living crap out of the second division teams. Well, that's what you're supposed to do. All right, now you're going to play first division teams. keep it up, you know, keep firing on all cylinders and everything should be fine. But that's why we watch the games. That's why we love the sport.
Sam, if
hopefully
I could just jump in here for a second.
Some, tough baseball through 2 weeks into November, but go ahead, Mike.
You talked about playing with leads and what the Mets need to do forward. I put this together on Tuesday, so it might be one game outdated. But Chris Bassitt, Carlos Carrasco, Tawan Walker, and David Peterson have joined together for a 36-16 record with a 3.43 ERA over 440 innings pitched. You talked about playing with the leads and that the Mets need to, you know, keep their guard up. And well, that needs to continue. If anything, I think the starting rotation has been, you know, the backbone of this team. That, as Phil mentioned,
yeah.
Buck Showalter. But this pitching needs to continue. Those four, you know, we've spoken a lot about Scherzer and DeGrom, but those four have really carried the load for this team, and that needs to continue.
You know, it's hard to cover every single player that has stepped up for this team, but that's a good place to go, specifically with Carlos Carrasco. Rich, this is somebody coming off of being injured most of the year last year, faltering in the first inning at the end of last year when he was finally able to pitch. He has been exactly what you wanted, as, you know, some people forget, half of the Francisco Lindor trade.
He really has. You know, you're going from a guy who had an ERA, I think it was around 6 last year, coming off of injuries, of course. But a guy who's getting up there in years, you know, Carrasco's 35 years old. And with the injury last year, with the subpar pitching, did you really have reason to believe that this guy would be, at this point, 13-4 with a 3.76 ERA? I mean, maybe you did, and you're smarter than me, because I could not have – I would have said if you get a 500 record out of this guy, it'll be great. Well, he's really stepped it up, you know. And yes, you know, they gave up Jimenez, who was an all-star, gave Rosario in that trade for Lindor. You got Lindor, who is having a fantastic season. But also Carrasco, right? Like you said, Sam, you can't forget the fact that he came with Lindor. And this team, while it has a balanced and effective offense, this team is going as far as its starting pitching will take it. The starting pitching is deep. You know, it'll be deeper when McGill comes back. Obviously, he may go to the pen. We don't know what will happen there. But a big part of that starting rotation depth is Carrasco. And we can't forget that. 13-4. Leads the staff in wins, my goodness. You know, he leads the staff in wins. And we often forget that he came with Lindor. You know, he's, quote, you know, the other guy who came with Lindor. Well, this other guy is leading the staff in wins. And so, yeah, you can't look past it. It was another very solid acquisition.
Phil, I think that Chris Bassitt's ERA jumped over the course of a five-game stretch, specifically after Scherzer went down, and it just didn't work for Bassitt. I think that the 3.76 ERA of Carlos Carrasco can basically be tied to like one or two games. That's how good he's been. That ERA jumped because of maybe just a quick shellacking.
Right, but what you're seeing right now, we're in the, you know, what's the fourth quarter of the season. So pros are going to be pros now. And this is what we have in him. You know, it's funny, we were talking about the DeGrom slider, but the Braves can't hit any sliders. And I made a comment to Sam, the only sliders the Braves get their hands on are ones from White Castle. Because they couldn't hit. they couldn't hit Scherzer's slider. They couldn't hit Carrasco's slider. They couldn't hit Diaz's slider. They couldn't hit DeGrom. That's all you got to do is throw them sliders all day, man. They are horrible. But Carrasco is—he's a pro. what you're getting out of Bassett, Carrasco, at the back end, and when Taiwan's on, is you're getting professional guys who are going to battle. Even if they give up two or three runs, they know to stop the bleeding. My team's got my back. It's a total offense, defense, special teams football analogy to say this is like a squad working in some kind of unison, osmosis with each other. They automatically pick each other up. It's kind of incredible to watch, especially the meetings in the clubhouse, I mean the dugout, in between innings. It's fascinating.
And we got to give credit where credit's due. Walker, obviously, he just and Rich, I'll go to you first here, and then Mike. He spiked the ball in that game against the Braves, and against the Reds, he seemed like he was a man on a mission to prove that he's not falling off like he did in the second half last year.
Did we lose somebody?
Rich, you there?
I'm still here.
Oh, go ahead, Rich. Taiwan Walker.
No, I lost you. Are you in the middle of your question? It cut out for me. I don't know. Did you hear him, Phil?
No, it did cut out for a second.
Okay. No, I was just saying that obviously, like, after spiking the ball against the Braves, he seemed to lose it. But, you know, against the Reds, he seemed like a man on a mission to prove that he's not the second-half pitcher that he was last year.
Exactly. You know, he had a bad outing at a bad time, right? You know, it was kind of the worst of all scenarios because we're well into the second half now. We know what happened to him in the second half last year, and he goes out there and gets pulled by the Braves. So the whole thing of spiking the ball, did he hurt himself or not? He said no. He took full accountability and said he was just bad. I don't know about you, but I was concerned after that game because, again, it takes guys time to build up their innings. You know, last year, he hadn't really pitched since 2018. 2019 and 2020, he didn't pitch much. Last year, we saw the effect of it. He started out great, now he goes out there against the Reds, and he gets the job done. He was very effective yesterday. He wasn't dominant, but he didn't have to be. You know, he was effective. Great. So, but I think you've raised one thing with Taiwan Walker where it's something worth watching as we go down the stretch here. Because, again, innings build up gradually. You know, last year we saw it. He was effective for about the first 100, 110 innings. Then he hit the wall. So where's that wall this year? I don't know about you, but I thought maybe it was after the Braves game because I tend to look up to the sky and see when the state's going to hit me in the head. But, okay, he was good against the Reds. I think Taiwan Walker is worth watching from here on out to see if it starts to look like he's losing something and that innings limit is coming back again, or should we say innings plateau. I do think that's a piece of intrigue for us to watch as the season goes along. And with McGill, set to come off the IL probably late this month, that's not a bad thing. To have a fresh arm and a fresh Tyler McGill in case Walker does run into innings issues again. I know they're staying McGill in the bullpen, but if Walker really shows that he's losing steam fast, maybe he's the guy you put in the bullpen, use him for an inning or two at a time. We'll see. But I think it's something worth watching.
Mike?
Taiwan Walker. I'm in lockstep with Rich. He wore down last year. You know, between 2018 and 2020, as Rich said, he pitched, you know, minimal innings, close to none. And, you know, last year he got up to a good start and he wore down. Rich is right. I have nothing more really to add. He has a career high of 169 innings pitched, but, you know, that was back in 2015. So Rich is right. Where is that wall? However, I do think coming off of last season, he's stronger, he's more fit, and he has more stamina. So, you know, if he could finish out the season, because we know in the playoffs we're going to shorten the rotation just a little bit, So, you know, hopefully he has enough to get us through the rest of the dog days and through the pennant race of September.
Phil, that's perfect place that he just segued. Last year, even though he did struggle mightily initially out of the All-Star, out of being an All-Star, he still finished the year. He still got those innings under his belt, and he also was better in September. So, do you, like, you know, like Mike said, I mean, that must have helped for increasing a potential wall, which hopefully will never come.
True. Well, the main thing is, obviously, we're making the postseason. He will be in the bullpen, Taiwan. He's not going to take Carrasco's place in that group of four. But moving forward, he needs to finish strong because isn't he next year a contract year for him? So you got to kind of prove that you got to be a little bastard and eat some innings. His troubles are always usually in the first two innings. If he doesn't have it, you can tell quite early with Taiwan. He's not going to lose it late. He'll lose it early. So it'll be interesting to see this 11-game stretch. He's going to have a couple of starts in there. Let's see what he does with the pressure on.
The pressure is certainly on. And, ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Mets Beat podcast, and I will go around the horn to make sure that we've covered everything. Guys, is there any outstanding material that you would like to cover? Going once? Going twice?
I just have one comment I'd like to say. I have one comment, and I'm always a big fan of his, but I want to say happy trails, Dom Smith. We ain't got no room for you, man. Right now, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Bro. I like you, you know, but no, it's not gonna work out.
I've always loved Dom Smith. I've always hoped that he could just cement his place on this team. But yeah, Rich, it's unfortunate, but one way or another, I mean, obviously, like, there's no waiver wire trades now, you know, like there used to be. This is probably going to get sorted out in the off season, but I don't see how he doesn't stick a AAA when the rehab comes back, when he's done with the rehab in AAA.
I think that's right, Sam. I it would be a shame to see the team go to the postseason without Dom because he's been here. You know, he's a original draft pick and all that, and kind of been here through the lean years and had that great 2020. But right, like Phil said, there's just no room for him. You know, you have guys who do what he does, and Dom was hitting 194. And the big man, Vogelbach, he gets on base at almost half the time, you know, 500, close 500. So you have that. You have Darren Ruff. You have Pete. You have Nate Quinn now is so Dom can even think about smelling the outfield. It's unfortunate, but, yeah, I mean, that – I think it sometimes it can be a cold business, as we know, and that DH spot with Dom and JD was just – it was abysmal. I mean, it was frankly – you remember all the talk of, oh, the Mets are going to benefit most of all the National League teams having a DH. They have so many guys suited to the role. Well, it was abysmal. And so they had to replace both of them, and they did. And the unfortunate thing is while JD's out in San Francisco, and I saw he hit a couple of home runs out there, I think, Dom doesn't have a place, didn't have a place to go. And so here's my hope. My hope is that he finds his way onto the roster at some point. I don't think he would make the postseason roster, but he gets a ring. If they, God willing, they should win a ring, that he would get one. And if he's moved in the off season, at least he goes out in style. So that's about all we can hope for Dom at this point.
Yeah, because, Mike, you know, it just seems like all he would be is a defensive backup at first base. That's really it at this particular point. It's just hard to
that's
find
baseball.
A space for him.
That's baseball. But don't forget, he gave us that walk-off home run that ended the 2019 season, the game you and I attended. So we'll have that.
I will always remember looking over to your left, Mike, and you and I just going, yeah!
I think that was the first time I jumped up and down at a game in quite some time. Did anyone take get a gander of the Old Timers Day roster?
Oh, good call.
No.
Let's see. I mean, it's giant, and that is a place to go. Let's see. Mets Old Timers game.
I think
I'll start here as I pull it up. A few managers too. But Rich, you know, a lot of people have been questioning why Wright can't make it. I'm kind of like, you know, that's kind of possibly personal and private. So who cares?
Apparently, he told the Mets the minute the day was announced that he wasn't going to be able to make it. And so he can't make it, you know. And nice and old – I don't really care, Zern, who isn't, but it's nice Old Timers Day is back. And I know that was a Steve Cohen thing. And the Mets hadn't done – I don't even remember last time they did an Old Timers Day. And that's Steve Cohen. You know, you see Steve Cohen's influence not only in the fact that they have the second highest payroll, very close to the highest, in Major League Baseball. So you see his influence there, but you also see it, in fact, teams playing better, but you see it in the upgrades. Like everything they're doing seems to have more class. You know, they're doing an Old Timers
right.
Day. They're acknowledging their history. They're doing the Seaver statue, all these different things. And, you know, it's kind of like the team's being run by adults now, and we're seeing the benefit of it. And I, for one, love it.
So, I do have the roster in front of me, and I think the biggest question, since it's so giant, is who is actually going to be participating. And it's also interesting that Davey won't be there, but Terry Collins, Joe Torre, Willie Randolph, and Bobby Valentine for the managers will. Mike, what do you think about that off the top?
Yep, no Jeff Torborg? Oh. that's a good foursome. Collins, Terry Collins, Joe Torre, Willie Randolph, Bobby Valentine, they're welcome. Friendly faces, bring them on. You know, hey, look, everyone has their reasons. If these four can make it, I'll be happy. I'll be happy if a great majority of these names make it.
And it seems also there's a little bit of outreach to Willie Randolph, the fact that he's making it, considering the way it all ended, and that Omar is still in the ranks of the organization, I believe.
I'm almost positive. Positive. City Field would give Willie Randolph a rousing ovation.
Oh yeah. So, what do you think?
I was just thinking about it, and I'm so used to the name Old Timers Day, but maybe David Wright just doesn't want to think of himself as an old timer.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking
and
of
Daniel,
myself, you know,
Daniel Murphy's leading into it.
But, you know, so they might eventually have to change the name of that game to maybe, you know, Mets Heroes Day or something shit like that, you know, something that's a little bit more majestic and not kind of, you know, like,
less Yankee,
you know, right. Like you're in a chair that rocks with an Afghan or some shit, you know, like all the time. They got to change the name. Eventually they're going to have to. And I think you have guys who are recently retired, not considering themselves old because David was not even what, 40. He might be
yeah.
just 40.
And and he's also, I mean, you know, there's probably a part of him that's thinking he should have, you know, he should be still playing, signing a second contract by now.
Yeah,
I forget what the other contract
yeah,
was about. But,
yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Is he going to get his number
point.
Retired by the Mets at some point? Is he going to get, you know, open the ring up there? I mean, he would be the next one, I would think, if you're going to do another player in Mets lore. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so guys, you know, it does say roster subject to change, and obviously just reading the entire list is going to queue up so many different conversations, but I feel like I have to do it. And I think the biggest question is who is actually going to play, who's going to be able to play or make at least an appearance in the game. So we went over the managers, and I'll just say, off the top of the list, it looks like the whole Yoenis Cespedes was indeed a partial April Fool's joke, but Bartolo Colon, who was kind of paired with that, is making it. So it's going to be Craig Anderson from 62 to 64, Bartolo Colon 2014-2016, David Cohn, Dennis Cook, Ron Darling, Steve Dillon, Sid Fernandez, John Franco, Dwight Gooden, Mike Hampton, which is a question of how his reception, whether it'll sound like the school bells in Denver, Jay Hook, Terry Leach, Al Leiter, Skip Lockwood, our friend who has been on the podcast before, Ed Lynch, Ken McKenzie, Pat Mahomes, that should be fun, John Matlack, Pedro Martinez, Roger McDowell, Bobby Ojeda, Jesse Orozco, Glendon Rush, Johan Santana, Doug Stisk, Steve Traxel, Billy Wagner, and Turk Wendell. That's rounding out the 28 pitchers who will be joining the Old Timers Day. Catchers, there's five listed. Tom Hundley, Mike Piazza, Todd Pratt, John Stearns, and Josh Tolley. That is lovely, especially the fact that John Stearns, it seems, will be making it. Whose health was a little low lately. So it's good to see that he's going to be healthy enough to make it. Infielders, 15, Edgardo Alfonso, Wally Backman, Rico Bronya, Kevin Elster, Keith Hernandez, Howard Johnson, Ray Knight, Ed Cranepool, Felix Mian, Daniel Murphy, Jose Reyes, Rafael Santana, Tim Tuffle, Robin Ventura, and Todd Zeal. And rounding out the old-timers' day is the outfield, which is 13 players, Benny Agbayani, Andy Chavez, Cliff Floyd, the Steve Henderson trade, as I like to call Steve Henderson, Cleon Jones, Lee Mazzilli, Kevin Mitchell, Jay Payton, Art Chamsky, Daryl Strawberry, Ron Svoboda, Frank Thomas, another friend of the podcast who's been on, Mookie and Mookie Wilson, rounding out the outfielders. I'll throw it to you first, Mike. Like, who do you want to see most on that field, no matter how old they are?
Sorry, dollar in the
Yo,
draw.
Yo, Mikey!
I'm here. A dollar in the draw. I'm very interested to see Frank Thomas. I hope he's well and he can get out on the field and receive just a great ovation for being one of the Mets' first ever superstars, slugger, home run hitter. So I'd like to know what kind of shape he's in and that he's able to enjoy his day. Ed Cranepool, similar situation. I hope he's in good health and that he's able to enjoy the day. Otherwise, on a lighter note, Steve Henderson, I'm very interested to see his reception. And of all these names, I feel most sorry for Ed Lynch because he didn't make it all the way through to Game 7 of the 1986 World Series with the Mets. Very underrated pitcher, and I've always felt sorry for him.
Rich, hearing that roster, where's your head?
Mazzilli. I can't get past it. Keith, of course. You know, Keith, to kind of echo what Mike said, you know, Keith is still with the organization. He's still very famous. You know, he's had a good relationship with the organization, never had a bad one ever since he came. But Mazzilli, to me, you know, Mike, you and I are the same age, and Mazzilli was all we had in the the late 70s, right? He wasn't a genuine superstar, but he was the best player on the team. And we had a chance to enjoy him, local kid, all that stuff. And then I was really disappointed when he was traded, and the fact that he played for the Yankees and he coached for the Yankees. He did the SNY stuff, then he disappeared again. Rumor had it he didn't have a good relationship with the organization, but now he's been doing some radio. And
he's just like, he's like your brother, man. You know, I'm telling you, he's the guy who got us through those lean years and carried the team on his back for whatever he could do. And he was kind of a, he was a local icon. And so, you know, I don't know that his relationship is great with the Mets now. It has to be better because he's been doing the radio stuff on occasion, and at least he associates himself with the organization again. But to me, I actually will be at Old Timers Day, and I think I'm going to save my biggest round of applause for Lee Mazzilli.
I'll be happy to see John Stearns as well. He was always one of my all-time favorites.
You know, and I agree, and I'm going to pass it over to you, Phil, but I just want to throw it out there since I mentioned him basically first other than the managers was Craig Anderson, 62-64. So other than Frank Thomas, you have another first Met, and you also have Jay Hook coming back, who was also a pitcher with the 62-64 Mets. And I believe that's it for the early old-timers, but Craig Anderson, who wore both 20 and 29, played for St. Louis prior to the New York Mets. He was drafted from St. Louis by the Mets, and he had a 5.35 ERA in that first season. But, Phil, I will go to you, and before you mention anybody, it's just so awesome that we still have some 62 Mets that are able to make this.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. I mean, it's oddity nowadays that you have that many. But in the point made about Lee Mazzilli, what he meant to Met fans, I think as a Met fan, one of your proudest moments you guys remember when he was co-MVP of the All-Star game, was it with Dave Parker?
79, right?
79, right, yeah. That was like, yeah, our guy made it, you know, that type of feeling. I'm a big Cleon Jones.
Especially in that year, which was, I don't know, 78 had the bubblegum contest with Bobby Valentine at least. Like, I don't know about 79, you know, the year before Wilfon.
But Cleon Jones has always been one of my sports heroes, so I'm looking forward to seeing him, not in the field, but just seeing him. But strangely enough, guys, the guy I'm really looking forward to seeing is Rafael Santana, because I think he is really hardly ever spoken of as far as the 86 team, and very few stories about him. But he was a steadying force in that infield and did have big hits during the season. So I'm kind of anxious to see him.
Yeah, and I do think that, and I'd like to go to Rich next with this. You know, Rafael Santana, he really is the most under-discussed 1986 New York Met, crazy enough. But it is amazing also how many 1986 New York Mets are going to be on this team, and I wonder whether there's going to be a big call to have as many of them out on the field as possible.
Yeah, I'm sure that has something to do with it. You know, it's the last championship team. The guys are at an age where they can still do it, right? As opposed to 69 Mets, things a lot harder for them. And, but yeah, you know, Santana was a guy who, he fit the profile of that team. You know, he was a solid performer. He didn't have to be an all-star. They had all-stars all around him. He didn't have to be. He was a great defender. I think he hit about, you know, 230 that year. But he found a way to come up with clutch hits. He was steady as could be at shortstop, and that's what they needed. Remember, they would when Fernandez was on the mound, they figured more fly balls, they would use Mitchell at shortstop and to try to get the extra bat in there. That was such a fun team. And, again, that's why I have that vibe with this team, because they could do those types of things where they can move the parts around to fit the situation. But, yeah, it'll be great to see Santana. Great to see Keith. Of course, Ron's always here too. But it should be fun. And I'm not, like I said earlier, I'm not so concerned about actually who is there. I'm just happy that there is an Old-Timers Day. There is a Seaver statue. They're doing the things that other organizations do, like embracing their history that was just barren for years. And all this stuff is happening. And that, to me, is more important than the actual humans who will be on the field that particular night.
Yep. Agreed.
All right, so I'll leave you guys with this, though. Mike, who do you want to see Pedro strike out? Because when I look at the when I look at the pitchers, I know that Bartolo is probably like he's going to look like he can still pitch in the majors. But thinking like who do I really want to see the most on this mound? Looking at this list, and other than Dwight, I would, and maybe Sid. I gotta look at the fact that Pedro Martinez. I'm very curious to see maybe him facing Daryl.
I'll be happy with any scenario. I'm with Rich. I'm just glad old Thomas Day is back.
And you know we got to wrap up here, but I will also leave it that it's nice to see Ray Knight's name there. Considering, you know, this is going into the theme of what we've been talking about, of how relationships with the franchise are being mended, and so that's another name it's just there's so many great names that you're just like, oh, that's nothing against David Wright, but who cares about David Wright at this point? You know, he's fresh off of 4 years ago saying goodbye to him. That was a big moment, and I do believe that he needs to be considered as one of the next who get their number retired, and that's when we're going to celebrate it. He is probably very focused on his family right now, and his family is in California. He is living in California, and he looks like he's just at peace with the decision, and you know, it is what it is. So everybody, stop worrying about what you don't have and focus on what you do have. And we got a number of names to look forward to here on, I believe, August 27th, when 2022 Old Timers Day, the first Old Timers for the Mets in a long, long time, comes up. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Metsian Podcast, and we're so thankful that you do. And we are off to our final word. First off, thanks to Tomorrow Media's Phil Maillard for joining us this evening. And one more shameless plug, Phil. By all means, tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me at tomorrowmedia.com, TUMARO media.com. And let's go Mets.
There you go. Do you have one more final word? Any other word other than let's go Mets?
No, I want to keep it short. We'll speak again after the 11-12 game series, and my tone might be quite different.
Well, thank you again, Phil, for joining us as always. Let's go Mets. And let's go around for some shameless plugs and final words from our co-conspirators. Mike, shameless plug, final word.
Shameless plug, Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. Look it up. Have a ride and enjoy some baseball history. Final word, there's another local rivalry. Brooklyn Cyclones are battling with the Yankee affiliate Hudson Valley Renegades for first place in the second half. And at 10:05 this evening, Cyclones defeated Wilmington 7-6 in 12 innings. So let's go Cyclones. There's less than 30 games left in season, and let's go Cyclones. To me, it's local pride, it's Brooklyn pride, and every so often this takes precedence over what's going on in Queens.
Yep.
Brooklyn baseball, baby. And of course, as we've documented, the first full all the way going to April minor league season, professional season to happen in a long, long time in Brooklyn. So way to go, Cyclones. Keep it up. Rich, shameless plug, final word.
Shameless plug, Mesmerize Online, final word. I'm going to channel my inner Sam Maxwell for two words, keep pushing. Now, not that the Mets show any sign of this, but now is not time to let up. 12 very difficult games coming up, 50 games in total. Keep pushing, gentlemen. Don't let all the good work go to waste. I don't think they will, but pedal to the metal the rest of the way.
Yeah, and, you know, because it was 2015, that was keep on pushing, and to change it up a little bit, I've been saying at certain points, keep it pushing. So, you know, trying to stay superstitious, as many baseball fans are. But @_ Sam Maxwell, Bedford and Sullivan, @BedfordSullivan, which is the story of Brooklyn and Dodgers, and my hopes for a television show regarding that. But that's my shameless plug and final word. Keep it pushing. Let's go Mets, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Let's have some great 12 games, 14 games, 50 games, and onward. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Take care.
Good night.